reclaiming who you really are and helping you remember what you didn't know you'd forgotten. Broadcasting to the world, you are listening to Michael Lilborn Williams and the Gospel Revolution.
Welcome to the Gospel Revolution Powercast for Friday, February 16, 2019. Broadcasting from the home of redemptionism, where we help you reclaim who you really are and help you remember what you didn't know you'd forgotten. We're coming to you from the heart of the gospel, where we say that a text without a context is a pretext for a subtext. But right now, with more consistent, persistent, repetitive CPR of the gospel, is the president and founder of the Gospel Revolution, Michael Williams. Hello, Mr. Michael. How are you?
I'm wonderful, Don. How are you today, my friend?
I'm as happy as a dog in a room full of rubber balls, mate. I'm just happy today. No other way to put it.
Well, unless it's a depressed dog who doesn't care that there's any rubber balls in the room.
There you go. A depressed dog. See, out of the heart, the mouth speaketh. And I've got a bit of a feeling that that's what you consider me to be now to you. A depressed dog.
A depressed dog.
Oh.
Oh my. Life keeps getting interesting, but I tell you what, I've been thinking over this series on Hebrews we're doing, and you know, I am we're coming up on Calgary, Alberta in goodness what, 2 weeks now.
yes,
is crazy. So Calgary is going to be topical Hebrews, not verse by verse study of Hebrews. That is going to be a really good study, I think. It's amazing how many topics the writer of Hebrews zeroes in on and does such a thorough job. There's a linkage here, really, that is really quite powerful, too, and we're going to get into all of that. Every time I open my Bible here to Hebrews chapter 4, the very first part of it. Now, we've completed chapter 4, but I'm going to go back to that. But I want to know, how are you today?
Mate, I'm fine. I am terrific. I've got a cup of coffee in front of me. I've got a cup of coffee, a glass of wine, and a cup of cold tea. I think I'll be right for about an hour.
Awesome. Well, we are off to the races.
It is 5 o'clock somewhere, isn't it?
Well, it felt like it that it was 5 o'clock here, actually. So.
Okay. All right. So you want to go back into Hebrews chapter 4.
I have to show this pivotal point of this teaching. I think that we cannot miss this point. You know, it's like one of those places in the road where you come up at Five Forks. You ever hear of Five Forks down in Georgia?
I don't know Five Forks, but I know I know the five ways at Woolloongabba in Brisbane.
See, and then many times at those places they have these signposts, and you see them in the cartoons all the time. You see them in the movies, and on it says, you know, 1,000 miles to Brisbane that way, you know, 3,000 miles to San Francisco that way. You know, it's you're at a point where it's letting you know there's many directions to take, and it's important that you know where you are and where you're going. That's the way I see every time I look up. That's the way I see it more so even now. Hebrews chapter 4, verse 1, 2, 3 is this point, this cog in the entire machinery here that turns us to the right direction as to the comparative study that we've done so far. He starts out in verse 4, you know, hey, you know, these guys didn't make it. He's already compared Jesus to Moses. He's compared Jesus to the angels, done all of these really important teachings. And then he started talking about this term today. You know, what does today have to do with these comparisons?
Now, you've been teasing us on this for 3 weeks. You don't ever get to it. You keep going back like plowing old ground. And I don't think we're going to get there, frankly. And, well, and if you get there today, well, that'll be a hell of a surprise.
Well, you know, we covered the chapter on it, so I don't know what we're going to do. So we've got to go back because I've had a couple of phone calls that people that they're, it's like they've been brought to the precipice of this entire thing. And they are like at that point, and they're still trying to determine which, wait, now. Oh, this is important, but wait, which way do we go now?
Well, hold on. Are we our brother's keeper? I mean, let them catch up. I mean, they can always listen to this again 100 times until they get it, can't they? What?
We could do that, or we can say, well, possibly Don didn't do as good of a job as he should have done. So.
Did these people give us a lot of money?
All of them I've talked to are contributors to the Gospel Brothers.
So I think we should go. I think we should go back and check this out. Then
do the whole thing. But this is very important, and I want to clarify this because after we do this, we're going on into chapter 5.
Yeah, one day.
One of the maybe not today, but. Today, if you will harden not your heart, Don. Jeez. Hello?
I just spilled some tea I was pouring.
Oh, my goodness. Okay. I'm sorry.
Yeah, keep going, buddy.
Let me just recap this chapter 4, 1, 2, 3. Chapter 4, 1, 2, 3. If you're studying Hebrews, remember chapter 4, 1, 2, 3. Chapter 4, 1, 2, 3. Now, why are we being so repetitive? Because this is key to understanding the entire issue of Hebrews and where this introduction, we've basically been in an introduction all of this time. And now he is taking on this pivot. He has lured us in, if you will. And here we stand. Now he said that the scriptures we're talking about are today. First off, we need to accept the fact that today never happened for the nation of Israel. It just didn't happen because the writer here says if today would have happened, then David would not have referred to another day. And he was talking about another today. I didn't put that in there. It's been funny when I've talked to people about this. So, Mike, you're saying, and now, so you're saying that today was not today for them, and today is not today for us. No, I'm not saying it. That's what the writer of Hebrews said.
Hang on, are you sure? Today is not today for us?
Today is not today for us. That is one of the greatest parts of this news is that today was not today for them, and today is not today for us.
And why are we worrying? Why can't you get past chapter 4?
Because we've got to make sure that we know when today took place. Because here in this book, we find out that today is the day you get to rest. Today, there's a today that gives complete rest. There is a today that didn't work for the nation of Israel. There's a today that the writer of Hebrews seems to be saying, you're pursuing a today that's already passed. And this pivotal point comes when he says in chapter 4, let us therefore. Now, if faith didn't work for the nation of Israel, there's two things that didn't work for the nation of Israel. We happen to be talking about their faith right now. He and other writers have told us that their obedience didn't work for them. They failed at keeping the law. Now we're talking about their faith. This is, I don't know of another place that talks about the faith that the nation of Israel failed to have as much as the rest of it talks about the law that Israel failed to keep. These two points are tantamount to each other. They both have to be seen as failures. Now, at what point did the law become fulfilled? So, as you juxtapose for the nation of Israel, the issue of keeping the law, we know they could not keep the law. The law was not given for them to keep. The law was given to bring us to Christ. What, so if they couldn't keep the law and they couldn't add faith to what they heard, then are both of these linked together, and were they both totally fulfilled at the cross? That's what this book is trying to tell us. As we've learned from Paul and many other things, that it's the obedience and the faith of Christ, the obedience and faith of Christ. That's the same as people looking for their own obedience now, trying to satiate God's wrath and also to obtain his mercy. But you see, us trying to believe is just as foolish as us trying to obey, because the nation of Israel did a real good job at proving to us the law could not be kept. They did a real good job proving to us that faith could not be added to what they heard. They just could not do it. And that's affirmed by Paul in the book of Romans. Now, I'm really keyed up about this, I guess you can tell, because it is such a central figure here. So now he's telling us, now, you know, if this happened to Israel and we're still trying to have faith, we're still trying to add faith to what we hear, guess what? We're in a great position of fear. It's kind of like where Paul, this is where these writings are very akin to Paul's writings for sure. When Paul told the Gentiles who were mistaken that Israel had been cut off so that the wild olive branch, the Gentiles, could be grafted in. And the Gentiles were going around glorying and, Jewish nation got cut off. We got grafted in. And Paul's saying, oh, wow, really? Very interesting here. And then he says, we should fear, because if God cut off the natural branch, what would cause him to spare you? The wild branch that got grafted in. What in the world would cause that to be different? The succinct and precise path through people's brains, trying to bring us to a conclusion, an absolute conclusion, that our obedience and our faith is not part of the new covenant. It just is not. So he's saying, let us fear. If the same requirement is on us that was on Israel, and Israel saw the Red Sea open, Israel saw all of these mighty miracles constantly, and they could not add faith to what they heard, you're screwed. Man, you talk about fear. If you are disappointed in the nation of Israel, just wait till you see what you got coming. So then he says, lest any of you should come short of it. Verse 2, for unto us was the gospel preached as well as unto them, but the word preached did not profit them, not being mixed with faith in them that heard it. Then this powerful transition, which we've covered, for we... And we've gone into that word we, and in no place. Here, this term shows up as plural, as we. We is plural. But the Greek word is never plural when it shows up in any place else in the New Testament. It is singular. So the understanding of it is, for one which believed enters into rest. So there is a today, there's a one person issue now. That one person, just like Joshua, eventually entered in. So Joshua enters in, Jesus entered in, Jesus entered in, Joshua entered in, Joshua entered in. And said, as I have sworn in my wrath, they shall not enter into my rest, although the works were finished from the foundation of the world. So here is this major pivotal point, and we've covered the rest of this chapter. We're going to pick up on chapter 5 from here, and then I'm going to ask you for your comments on what I've just shared. We need to make sure that I'm coming across clearly here. So you got to critique this, Don, and run behind me here with the Greek. is this transition from emphasis on them, the nation of Israel, and this fear that if they didn't believe, you know, and if today didn't happen for them, when is today? And then to this transition then to verse 3, that if one believed, because there was a declaration that they would not enter into his rest without belief. Without faith, there was no entrance into God's rest, which happened before the foundation of the world.
Like the lamb that was slain before the foundation of the world?
Exactly like that one.
All right.
What sayest thou? Speaketh. Thou hast been more silent in the last 5 minutes than I have heardeth thou in the last 5 years.
Well, that dirty dog reference is really bitten deep, mate.
It bites, doesn't it?
So let's read it through in the Greek. We may be afraid then, lest at some time a promise being left of entering into his, the word in the Greek is stopping, we say it's rest, any one of you may be seeming to be deficient. So
so even we should be afraid then.
Yeah, we should be afraid. Yeah. For we also have been evangelized, even as those also, meaning the ancient Israelis. Now, there's an interesting thought that unto Abraham was preached the gospel, unto ancient Israel was preached the gospel.
And the gospel is righteousness by faith. That's what the gospel is righteousness by faith.
Verse 2, for we also have been evangelized, even as those also, but the word heard does not benefit those hearers. Now, I want to go back to Romans chapter 10, where it says, but didn't everybody hear? Paul,
yes,
sarcastically and ironically, says, but you're saying that if you hear the word, it's going to be, everything's going to be cool. But but I'm saying, didn't everyone hear? And what did it do for them? How did that work out? So here he's saying, but the word heard does not benefit those hearers. So hearing the word is not beneficial, just isn't beneficial. Not having been blended together with faith in those who hear. Okay, so the problem for those who hear the gospel is that what they hear is there's no faith there to act as an igniter, I suppose. Verse 3, he says, then we who believe are entering into the rest, according as he has declared, as I swear in my indignation, if they shall be entering into my rest, although the works occur from the foundation of the world. Now, along here, we see that only a believer can enter into the rest.
Yes.
Now, here he is saying, we're entering into a rest. But when it came to believing, John 3:19, we were all in darkness. That was the condemnation. It wasn't hell. It was that we're in darkness. We couldn't believe if our lives depended on it.
And imposed darkness.
Contrived darkness. What he's saying here is it's really a conundrum. You need to believe to enter into the rest. You can't believe. You don't have any faith to mix with what you've heard. Mm-hmm. You've heard all of this stuff, but you lack the faith to ignite your belief.
And to enter into a rest that was completed before the foundation of the world. So we're dealing with so many tilts. No wonder people are having difficulty with this, because we have so much of standing. There's 5 points, as I've said earlier, with signs pointing in all these directions, giving you the choice. It's up to you. You know, the fact of it is, you're the one's going to have to decide about this. But the fact is, only one could believe. The fact is that you're dealing with a very odd conundrum here, that you are trying to enter into something that was finished and done before the foundation of the world anyway. So there's a whole lot going on here. So now we went through the rest of chapter 4. We found out that if you're going to try, verse 7 is very important. And again, he limited a certain day. So today is not today. What is today? Today is a certain day. Right?
Uh-huh.
Now, Don, what does the word certain mean when it's saying, now this is a prophecy out of Psalms 95, verse 7. How certain is that certain day? Is there anything about that today could be the day, or tomorrow could be the day, or last week could have been the day today?
Well, he put me actually limited. The word limited defines certain means. Again, he puts boundaries around a given day, might be the best way of it. So it's a very, it is a certain day in as much as there are boundaries around it, and it's been fenced off and it's been put aside, and something kind of special is going to happen on this given day.
Then he says in verse 8, for if Joshua or Jesus had given them rest, then would he not afterward have spoken of another day? So that certain day was not even available for the nation of Israel.
Boy, that's a hell of a game to play for a God that's supposed to love his people. Crikey, that's...
So what we have here is a today that did not happen for the nation of Israel, could not have happened for the nation of Israel, and a today that the people now of the new covenant are trying to find that was settled before the foundation of the world and that only Christ could bring us into. So is this something that Christ failed to do for us?
Well, verse 8 says, there remains, therefore, a rest to the people of God. Well, I thought Israel were the people of God. How can they miss out?
That's who he was referring to here. He's not referring to us. The contextual progression of the story is saying that because Israel missed it at the point of their story, there still remained a day of rest that had not come because it had been cordoned off in the future for them from the foundations of the world. Now, you got to put your thinking caps on, folks. I can't do what's been done for 2,000 years, and that's skim over this and just let, oh, well, today, you know, well, and then get up and preach a sermon. Today, says the Lord, today, if you will harden not your heart, you know, you can get into the promised land. You can have salvation today if you don't do it. But it's today. God, what does the scripture say? Today, and today means today.
You missed your calling. I can hear you being a preacher in one of those snake handling churches over in East Tennessee.
You were almost ready to come to the altar, weren't you?
I felt a quiver.
Like a dog.
Dirty dog. I felt a certain quivering in my heart, but I think it was my age.
And then, of course, after he says there remaineth a rest, therefore unto the people of God, which that term is, as you said, a term that was used for Israel. And in the progression of the story, that's where that's at. Then he says, for he that is he, singular, that has entered into his rest, he also hath ceased from his own works as God did from his. So not only did God cease from his labors, he sent Christ here, took the place of the entire human race, pulled the entire human race into his own body, and then Christ ceased from his labors, as he said at the cross, it is finished. Now, this is just such a beautiful picture. I admit that I feel very much at a loss of intellect and words and expressions to try to communicate this in the way that it's so crystal clear in my heart.
You don't want me to comment on that, do you?
Yes, I do. Please.
That you are an intellectual loss.
Yes, please.
And get fired?
Yes, please.
I think I'll just keep my trap shut.
Am I overstating this today, Don? Am I, and a lot of my reaction this morning is from about three phone calls that I was on.
Well, who rang you? Tell me who they were, and I'll tell you.
I'm not going to do that.
Ah, see, these people, they're anonymous. They're just like all those people who make crazy claims in the government. They're all anonymous. That doesn't work for me. I'm sorry. These people might be as intellectually moribund
as I am. People,
they might be just as intellectually bankrupt as you, mate. And then all we've got is a kerfuffle of chickens scratching around in the yard trying to pick up one worm.
Well, I tell you, I can handle that, but let's get the worm, okay? Come on, help me.
Okay.
You're being no help at all today.
I just don't feel like being... I really don't feel like helping you much anymore. I just think that, you know, you call me a dirty dog and there's got to be a price attached to that, mate.
So that's where we are. And then, of course, it goes on down into verse 12 and 13. It's like, and if you think you're going to fake your way into this believing, guess what? God's word is quick and powerful and sharper than any two-edged sword. It divides asunder even the thoughts and asunder the soul, the spirit, the joints, the marrow, and is a discerner of the thoughts and the intents of the heart. And neither is there any creature manifest in his sight, but all things are naked and open unto the eyes of him, which whom he we have to do. Seeing then, we have a great high priest that is passed into the heavens, Jesus, the Son of God, let us hold fast
that profession. Not our profession.
Not ours.
Who is that profession? You know that you teach that everything that was a what in the Old Testament became a who in the New Testament. Let's reread chapter 3, verse 1. And as I said, this has become a real anchor point for me. Wherefore, holy brethren, partakers of the heavenly calling, whatever these people are, they're partakers of the heavenly calling, consider the apostle and high priest of our profession, Christ Jesus. Now, when we dissected this, we realized that what was our profession? Our profession was not something we said. Our profession was a man by the name of Christ Jesus.
Yes.
Uh-huh. He's our high priest.
Who was faithful. So it's very clear that the what became a who.
Can you think of anywhere else in Hebrews where it makes Jesus our profession?
Yes, the apex of belief. He's not said the last he's got to say about it, because he goes all the way from these chapters, and let's advance just a moment, if you will, to chapter 12, right after the Hall of Faith of the Hall of Fame of Faith Heroes.
The Heroes Hall of Faith.
Thank you.
keep going, you dirty dog.
The Heroes Hall of Fame of Faith in chapter 11. Then we go into chapter 12. Wherefore, seeing we also are compassed about by so great a cloud of witnesses, let us lay aside every weight and the sin which doth so easily beset us, and let us run with patience the race that is before us. Looking now, while we're running this race, we should be looking unto Jesus, the author and finisher of faith. Wow. Who for the joy that was set before him endured the cross, despised the shame, and is set at the right hand. So when was today? Now that sounds really weird. It's like the nation of Israel saying, when will today come? Well, it's today, stupid. you know, oh, we're waiting for today. You're waiting for today. You know, there's only one thing that I can think of that you can't wait for, and that's today.
Yeah. Yeah, you wait for it for a week, and when it comes, it's today.
And you can't wait for it for a week because the day you start waiting for it, that's today. So now here we are. They were looking for a today to happen. We're looking for a today that did happen. Now, why the writer has chosen to do this little trick, word trick with us, I don't fully understand yet, but I think there's something more to be learned here. So who is the author and finisher of faith? What did the Israelites not be able to do? What were the Christians of the first century trying to do? They were trying to do the same thing that the Jewish people failed at, obedience and faith, obedience and faith. The nation of Israel completely failed at obedience and faith. Jesus came and completed obedience and faith. And now we have everybody in the new covenant in the first century here trying to complete obedience and faith again. Thank God there were people, being that the book of Hebrews was not written by Paul. We would have more than one person who understood this during that time. This does link up and match up as we're able to look at the book of Romans and pull out supportive things for this book of Hebrews for sure. So, like we say, whoever this was, goodness gracious, he worked closely with Paul, no doubt, or at least closely with the Holy Ghost, the great teacher.
Well, he had to, because there is no, there's not even a smidgen of this concept in, James, in the two alleged books written by Peter, in the book written by Jude, or the books written by John, the five books written by John. Yeah. There is no mention of that concept in any of those books. So, yes, there's no question that when Paul said in Galatians 1, these perverts who are teaching another gospel, which is not a gospel at all, there is no question. You cannot possibly argue or even suppose for a moment that there was only one gospel being preached in the New Testament. You can't do it. You've got to have rocks in your head to argue that. Mm-hmm. Someone was preaching another gospel. Now, we in the 20th century have been taught and elect to believe that, well, there were some bad people out there teaching, you know, Simon the magician and this person and that person. No. It's very clear who they were. All we got to do is read their books in the New Testament. Mm-hmm. It's those people who knew Jesus very well in his lifetime and could not dissociate themselves from the law. Mm-hmm. So they kept trying to do the things that the people were trying to do under the law. They didn't hear the words of Jesus, or if they heard them, they didn't listen. There is a difference. Mm-hmm. That when Jesus said, you can believe if you tried because you're under a curse.
Yes.
Dummy. But these people didn't hear that.
Yeah.
And they just kept on wanting to obey a la James and believe a la Peter and John and confess their sins, yeah, a la the whole Old Testament of Israel.
And we still are doing the same thing today.
2,000 years later,
yeah,
no one seems to have picked it apart except, well, a very few people.
Yeah. And, you know, and I understand people's frustration with us, Don, because they read all of the teachings of the New Testament as though it were scripture, which is just totally out to lunch. I'm telling you, that is one of the most bizarre concepts that has ever been brought up by Christianity. And it is absolutely mandatory that you think that the entire New Testament is scripture, because Christianity falls apart if it's not.
Look at the difference between how the Bible was canonized, mm-hmm, allegedly canonized, I say formalized, and the U.S. Constitution was formalized.
Yeah.
Huge difference. In the U.S. Constitution, you had people who opposed each other but came together and said, okay, this is the best of all possible worlds, and we all are prepared to put our signature to this.
Yes.
There was consensus.
Yes.
There was no consensus.
None.
when it came to how the Roman Catholic Church said what books should be in and what books should be out. No consensus. There was a lot of blood shed.
Yeah.
There was a lot of murder happening, but no consensus.
Mm-hmm.
So think for a moment. Now, in the United States where I live, people revere the Constitution. You know, many people are in America and they wish the Constitution wasn't the Constitution. They want to change the Constitution. They want to take some of those amendments and change them to be something else or not to be there at all. But that's after the fact. The fact that we're considering right now is that the Constitution was created by men who were absolute mental giants.
Mm-hmm. Even though they opposed each other in ideas.
Exactly. Not so the Bible.
No.
And so if you try to take some books in the Bible and correlate them with other books, frankly, you're going to give yourself a midlife crisis. You really are.
So in other words, to hold the comparison clear, we would have had a constitution by Adams, a constitution by Jefferson.
Oh, yes.
Go right down and then try to figure out what all this means based on one-sided view of each and every one of these issues.
Yes, we'd spend Sunday after Sunday, year after year, decade after decade saying, I wonder who was writer. Was it Jefferson? Was it Washington? Was it, Adams?
Yeah.
How crazy
it
is that?
Been very crazy. But
I'm sorry, I took you off this. You've taken us to chapter 12 and verse 2, looking unto Jesus, the author and finisher of faith. Now, if you have a problem with what Mike said there, the word our is not there. He authored and finished faith.
Which is exactly what we just read. It was finished before the foundation of the world, author, until today came, which was the cross, finisher.
The finisher in the Greek means the one who finishes off the job, the completer.
Yes.
The completer.
Mm-hmm.
Some people say the consummator. Now, not the consummation, the consummator, meaning a person. He is the person who architected. The word for author is archaos, and it's a word for which we get architect. And he architected and
built it.
He started.
Put in the last nail.
Exactly. And he finished it. We don't. I don't have to go back and say, oh, shoot. Maybe it needs another nail in here.
Yeah. Boy, and isn't that what Christianity is? It's driving a nail in the wall and hanging all their doctrine on one thing, Jesus.
And you brought us here, so I've got to look at the rest of this verse. Who for the joy that was set before him endured
goodness.
The cross, despising the shame, and is set down at the right hand of the throne of God.
And when did that happen?
That, for me, well, it happened over time.
Today.
Yeah. Well, yes, it happened over time, though. Mm-hmm. Who, for the joy that was set before him, I see that happening in the Garden of Gethsemane, which I'll come back to, endured the cross. That happened on the day of the Lord, the cross, despising the shame. In fact, the word shame means the disgrace, the attendant disgrace. Yeah, just think about it for a minute. You're hanging naked. All your package is hanging out there for everyone to see. You're hanging naked in front of your mother, in front of the disciple that calls himself the one that you loved most. Think about that. You're hanging out there naked. Was there disgrace? Oh, heck yeah. And is now set down at the right hand of the throne of God. That happened afterwards. So, but let me just, what was the joy that was set before him, Mike? The joy that was set before him, as far as I'm concerned, was Mike Williams. Was Don Bartlett, was every single person who's ever drawn a breath. We were the joy that you were the joy that was set before him. You were his dream.
Yes. And we get through this life by considering him, the author and the, consider him, the author, consider him, the author and finisher. Consider him, please, for God's sake, at least consider him to be the author and the finisher of faith.
And our profession. He is our profession. Not the words that come out of our mouth.
Yes, the profession of it.
Yeah.
Yes.
Oh, wow.
He is the faith and the professor of it. He is the profession. He's the confession.
And so it is, folks, that we must leave you. I mean, right there, family, right there. There's a podcast right there. Now, we've only been talking for a short time, but we are going to get back, and I'm going to hold Michael's feet to the fire here. Yeah. We're going to start in chapter 5 of Hebrews, or Hebrews, or whatever it is.
Hebrews.
Hebrews, okay.
You know, and Don, let me say this before we go on, before you hold my feet to the fire. I understand people who are entrenched in Christianity for getting upset with us because these are thoughts they've had all of their lives. I remember going through this. I was challenging my own thoughts. I was upset with me. And
I would be too if I was you.
And all of these concepts were coming to my mind that absolutely were contrary. Now, just think about how frustrating this is going to be for them when they stand up and they're preaching and they say, you know what Mike Williams said? You know what that Don Bartlett had to say? They said today doesn't mean today. The today doesn't mean today. Oh, wow. That's how stupid this gospel revolution is. They actually say they have to play Twister. They have to say today does not mean today. Well, let me give you just a little bit more to laugh about.
Here we go.
It's not us who said today is not today. It is the writer of the book of Hebrews that said, you got today mixed up. That the nation of Israel missed today. And you are missing it too. So we're trying to bring you back to the today where all of that which was completed before the foundation of the earth was absolutely finished in Christ. I'm ready for you now.
Yeehaw! So, chapter 5, verse 1. Now, remember that we just covered again chapter 3, verse 1, looking unto, or chapter 12, and chapter 12, verse 2. So, we're considering the high priest of our calling and the profession of faith, Jesus Christ.
That's what this whole book is about.
For every high priest, he's bringing it back to high priests now.
Yes.
Taken from amongst men or chosen from men, is ordained for men, not ordained for God, ordained for men in things pertaining to God, that he may offer both gifts and sacrifices for sins. Now, here he's talking about the Old Testament high priest who once every year went into the Holy of Holies, and he in which was the Ark of the Covenant and everything that was in that. And they'd tie a rope around him in case he had sin in his life, unconfessed, I suppose, according to John. And he in case he died in there, because there was was a big deal. And then he would take the sins of the people and put them on one goat and send that goat off into the desert. And then on the other goat, he'd cut its throat and there would be a sacrifice. And sins were not only forgiven but forgotten for a year. So he's talking about these people. I'll read this again. For every high priest who is a man is ordained for men. The purpose of their ordination is not for God, it's for men.
Mm-hmm.
In things relevant to God, that he may offer both gifts, the high priest, and sacrifices for sins. Now,
Don, let me ask you, the word sins is plural here, but we always get, whatever it is, we'll take that. But we need to know at this point exactly what we're talking about. Is this plural? Plural would be actions against the law, and singular would be Adam's transgression. Now, I don't know which one it is.
Okay, it's plural. It's Mrs. Let me just check.
Okay.
Because and that makes sense because he's talking about the high priest, which was dealing with
about the law.
Yeah, yes. Exactly. So,
so it is true. So the earthly that makes perfect sense because an earthly high priest could not deal with Adam's transgression. The only transgressions that the earthly high priest could deal with was transgressions against the law.
Exactly.
Wonderful. All right. We did learn something that's going to be helpful, I'm sure. Already is.
Who can now, he's a high priest. He offers gifts and sacrifices for sins. Who can have compassion on the ignorant and on them that are out of the way? That's an interesting word. For that himself also is compassed with infirmity. Oh, man. What a mouthful. Let me just read that in. He should be able to deal gently with their failings since he knows what it's like from his own experience. That's the message. That's pretty good, actually.
Yeah.
Okay. And by reason of that, he ought, as for the people, so also for himself to offer for sins. So he had to offer for his own sins. And then he had to offer for the sins of the people of Israel.
Now, so we're going to get a comparison here. Now, you've got a very clear understanding here in Hebrews 5 about the earthly priesthood. Now, so far, it has limited the ability of that priesthood to deal with transgressions of the law. Now, we know that there was the transgression of Adam, which hasn't been touched by a priest up until this point, cannot be touched by a priest. That, and it stands to reason that if the transgression of Adam is eliminated, then the law itself, which was built around the transgression of Adam, would by necessity be done away with.
Say that again.
There would that the law would by necessity be done away with because it had to be built around the transgression of Adam. The only thing that brought sin into the world was Adam's transgression.
Well, hold up.
So sin wouldn't even be in the world, so the law would no longer be even necessary.
Are you going to hold up and let me talk?
No, come on.
Even a
what sayest
even
thou?
A dirty dog has his place, you know.
Arf, arf.
Jesus. Well, it occurred to me that the high priest that we're talking about here was a high priest for the nation of Israel, and the nation of Israel did not even exist. It wasn't a glint in anyone's eye until well after Adam. So, the high priest was limited in what he could do for the people, to those people who were both temporarily or temporally and geographically and culturally and ethnically associated with Israel. It was, and Israel started yonks later, and then so Moses brings the law down, and the high priests are part of that law. How can they retrospectively forgive Adam's sin? That would take a higher priest, wouldn't it?
It would take a higher priest, and it would take a lower realm of transgression to point out the higher realm of transgression. If they didn't know what a transgression of Adam was, how were they ever going to learn unless there were laws created to understand what a transgression is? Now, the law did not create the transgression. The law pointed out that was designed to point out the transgression, which was not the breaking of the law, it was the transgression of Adam. So here the law, now we're getting a good view of this.
And that would include things like murder, thou shalt not kill, as Cain and Abel. I mean, it identifies, even Hammurabi in centuries later, the Code of Hammurabi still exists today in England and Australia and in the United States because it was such a well-thought-out presentation of law and personal responsibility and so forth, and it comes from the Ten Commandments. You don't kill anyone. That's a bad thing to do. It'll spoil your weekend. Don't steal. Yeah. And for goodness sake, be careful what you do with your neighbor's ass.
Mm-hmm.
Not to mention wife. So
you do have some in you, don't you?
Oh, I push the limits.
Gospel revolution.
See, we need to understand that the law had a purpose. It was to bring us to two points. It was to bring us to what sin is, number one, which had nothing to do with the things that the law forbade at all. That sin had something to do with something else, and that the end of sin had something to do with something else other than goats and sheep and keeping of the law, that there was a day coming that the law was designed to bring us to Christ. It was to bring us to the faith of Christ.
Well, I love what Paul says. It was a schoolmaster to bring us to Christ. Yes. It was just a schoolmaster.
Yeah, and you know, we're not out to try to appease the schoolmaster. We're looking to see where all of this began and see that it was eradicated all the way back to Adam, that the problem doesn't exist anymore. The problem that Christianity is still dealing with was simply instituted to show us what the real problem was, and somehow Christianity has missed it altogether. Mm-hmm. I mean, completely missed it altogether. So all of the priesthood was appointed, called of God, as was Aaron. That's the tribe of Levi,
which is where tithes came from, because these guys, all they did, yes, all day was offer sacrifices, I guess, and
come up with the laws.
Yeah, come up with the laws, and someone had to pay their way.
Now we've got a good comparison. So now these things from among men, for men. This was among men, for men, in things that related to God. From within the ranks of men to handle the things for men in things that related to God.
You might think it's being pedantic here, but it wasn't came from men to work with God in things that pertained to God. You know, it was, yeah.
No, and that's vitally important, Don, that we maintain that thought as we go through. These priests did not come here for God. They came here for us in things, as the word is inserted here, pertaining to God. All right. Now, so we've got that. And they did offer sacrifices for the sins. Obviously, their sacrifice was only for the transgressions that were against the law. And then we pick up with verse 5, and we're going to see where these comparisons, I would say, I've not read ahead in a long time here, but I'd say we're going to have to learn where these things compared to Christ are similar and where they are dissimilar and where they depart from that norm. Obviously, Christ departed from that norm, and from what ways did he? So let's start in verse 5 and go on from there.
And no person takes this honor unto himself or appropriates this honor. No person of his own self will appropriate his honor, but he that is called of God, as was Aaron. Now, boy, does this, I mean, what's your calling, brother? Oh, my calling is this or that or the other. We've taken that verse and turned it into a bloody religious house brick. And no man takes this honor unto himself, but he that is called of God, as was Aaron. Now, God called the priesthood out of the tribe of Levi. He only ever had to do it once and said, everyone in the tribe of Levi, you are Levites, you have certain responsibilities and job descriptions. Then he says, so also Christ glorified not himself to be made a high priest, but he that said unto him, so we're going to find out now, who did make him a high priest? Mm-hmm. And here we come across a part of the Bible that is, again, such a well-known part of the Bible and has been used by some cult sects and denominations to build whole belief systems.
Yes.
So who did call Christ? Because he didn't call himself. No, the person that called him was the same person who said, "You are my son. Today I have birthed or begotten you."
Mm-hmm.
That word birthed is geneo, which is birthed. It means to procreate or conceive.
Okay, so far what we've learned then is that the first priesthood came out of man. This priesthood came out of God, because he says in verse 1, "For every high priest is taken from among men, is ordained for men in things pertaining to God." But then Christ, he says that instead of calling him out of men, he says, "Thou art my beloved son. Today have I begotten thee." So Christ is the priesthood that comes out of God. So, Don, is that are we congruent right now? Is that what this is saying?
We are copacetic. We are congruent. I never heard that word copacetic until I came to America. It was like,
really?
I didn't even know what praetorism was, to be honest with you. I'd never heard.
Yeah.
And a pastor said to me, "Are you a praetorist?" Because I was so infected with you at the time. This is, oh gosh, I don't know, back in the hood 7 years ago. And I said, "What's a praetorist?" I must right then and there, he must have realized I was had no substance.
Yeah, and you're like, "How dare you? I've never molested anybody in my life."
Yeah, I love children. Oh, dear, oh, dear.
All right, so we know that that this priesthood came out of God. The former priesthood came out of man, called by God out of man, but this priesthood differs in this, that it did not come out of man. So the first priesthood identified with men because the priest that went to the altar had the very same faults and sins as the people he represented. Now we're doing a bit of a switch here.
Well, those priests were allowed to marry. So, I mean, he had to have the same failings as the rest of us.
Indeed.
Are you getting a bit testy with me, mister?
So here we have the number one difference here that's already brought up. And let's continue to read why this priesthood that come out of God rather than out of the tribe of – so Jesus did not come out of the tribe of Levi.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Didn't deserve to be a priest. Couldn't be a high priest. Nope, couldn't do that. We might discover he might become a great high priest. He was never a high priest. Mm-hmm. So now, "Thou art my son, today I have birthed you," comes from the scriptures. It's a quotation from the Old Testament. Mm-hmm. Now we're going to hear another quotation, because what the writer of Hebrews is doing is he is establishing Christ's preeminence as a priest. So we keep going into verse 6.
He's doing it through the scriptures.
Yes. The only place that... Okay, and he said also in another place, "You are a priest forever, after the order of Melchizedek."
Let me tell you, the one thing we're not going to do is try to figure out who the hell Melchizedek was.
Not going there. I had the jigsaw. It covered our whole kitchen table, and I still couldn't finish it, mate.
We ain't going there. We're going to take the comparison, and we're going to accept it. Now, what is the comparison that... let's read the comparison. This is how he compares to Melchizedek.
Who, in the days of his flesh, so when he was living, when he had offered up prayers and supplications with strong crying and tears unto him that was able to save him from death, and was heard in that he feared, though he were a son, yet learned he obedience by the... You're going to have to unpack this, mate. Yet learned he obedience by the things which he suffered, and being made perfect, He became the author of Eternal Salvation, an author again. Okay. He's the author of faith. Now he's the author of Eternal Salvation unto all them that obey him.
Mm-hmm. All right. So we're not talking about Melchizedek here.
Well, let me just read the next verse. Called of God. Now,
a high priest after the order of.
Yeah, Melchizedek.
So verse 7 and 8 are not talking about Melchizedek. Verse 7 and 8 are talking about the priest who is being the great high priest who is being compared to Melchizedek. This is what Christ went through, was able to save him from death. Wow. So what did Christ know? God was able to save him from death.
Oh, wow. That right there is just like a year's worth of meditation. I mean, if Jesus did not want to die, he could have, you know, there's an old Christian hymn called, he could have called 10,000 angels. But actually, all he had to do was call out to his Father, according to this.
Yes, that is exactly what it says. And it says that he offered up prayers and supplications with strong crying and tears. And we've got record of that day. And that was in the garden. And where he sweat as though it were great drops of blood. And where he couldn't get the disciples to stay awake. What was wrong with the disciples? I think it was the stupor that God had put. I think the stupor was taking full effect because it was vitally important that no one interfere with this process now. We almost have it going here, and we can't have you dudes messing it up.
Well, we see it happening again. It's like Christ was able to drop a veil and open and lift the veil. I mean, remember when they were on the road to Emmaus and they didn't have a clue who he was. He could, yes. Yeah, and it wasn't until after he left their presence that they said, "Oh my God, that was Jesus," and we didn't know. Yeah. I mean, how stupid are we? So it seems like Christ played this game. That's all I can call it. I'm going to hide myself from you, and then I'm going to demand you believe in me. This is going to be fun. I mean,
and then hide again,
Yeah.
I'm going to come out and say, believe in me, and then I'm going to hide.
Golly.
And Christianity has been playing hide-and-go-seek ever since because they missed the story.
I don't think so. They've been playing cut-and-paste, bait-and-switch, hit-and-run.
Well, whatever it is, it's a game, that's for sure. And though he were a son, yet he learned obedience from the things he suffered. Now, here is the term obedience showing up. Now, you see, Christ is about to become something that he's never been, ever. Never been. Now, Jesus obviously was born the Son of God today. He says he's begotten him. But now he's going through a process to become something he has never been. There is no record of Jesus being a priest of any kind while he was on this earth.
Nothing.
He wasn't even of the priesthood that appointed priest. Jesus never pretended to be a priest. He never inferred that he might become a priest. But here he is going through a process that will make him the great high priest.
Now, that word obedience, that's a fascinating word. Could Jesus have disobeyed? Well, I don't know. Could he have fallen for the temptation in the wilderness? If he couldn't have, it wasn't a temptation. I don't know. But this word obedience is really a bad translation. The word in the Greek means you listened. You listened to something. It was the same thing that you do in grade 3 when you're learning your times table. You listen.
You learn to listen.
Yeah, attentive hearkening is the description given by James Strong's. And he says as a secondary, by implication, meaning is compliance or submission. Now, let's just take the first one. And let's just read it through. Though he were a son, yet learned he how to listen properly by the things which he suffered. Now, let me remind you of a verse Paul talks about. He says, work out your salvation in fear and trembling. Let me give you the Don Bartlett translation, which is, and in the vicissitudes of life, as you live every day, in the traumas, that's the word in the Greek, traumos, and phobias, that's the word in the Greek, phobos, in the traumas and phobias of life, let your salvation be worked out. Is that, do you think, what was happening to Jesus as he was learning to listen?
Yeah, and I'd like to point out that it's to let your salvation be worked out, not worked in.
Yeah, or even anything
all
else.
All Christianity is trying to work it in, you know.
So this word obedience means attentive listening. We'll go with Strong's definition. Though he were a son, yet learned he by attentive listening. You know, I remember Jesus said, I do those things which I see my Father do, or which I hear my Father do, by attentive listening, by the things which he suffered. That's the phobos and traumos of life. There's a phobias, but it's a much deeper word. And being made perfect, he became the author of eternal salvation unto all them who, listen to this, listen attentively.
Yes.
Not who obey, who listen attentively.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's if you listen to this attentively, it'll be salvation to you. I'll guarantee you that. Now, it's and being made perfect. Now, this is a point that when I taught this the first time 21 years ago now, down in Florida, this term really grabbed my attention. And this is what was revolutionary for me back at that time, was that Jesus had to be made perfect at something that he was not perfect at before.
Wow.
Now, was he the perfect Son of God? He was perfect from his birth. That's what it says. This day have I begotten thee. You're the perfect Son of God. Was he perfect in righteousness? He was perfect in righteousness. You can go down the list. He was perfect in everything. But there was something he was not perfect at. He was not perfect at being the great high priest. He had to pass through death to enter this perfected high priest arena and to represent everyone. Now, we treat Christ as though he is still an imperfected priest.
How so?
By going back and doing sin over again and again and again. The reason they had to do it over again and again is because it never worked. Why did it never work? Because they weren't perfect.
Well, that's what the writer of Hebrews says. He says, for if those sacrifices had worked, you wouldn't have had to repeat them. Oh, what's this, chapter 10 or something?
Yep.
You wouldn't have to repeat them every year.
Exactly. So we have this perfection. And man, I tell you what, it's Christianity is going to have to wake up and figure out this very disturbing reality.
Do you know why that's not going to happen?
Yeah, because they're still trying to prove themselves right.
That's it. They've got two millennia of doctrine and dogmas to admit that they were wrong with.
Yeah,
it ain't going to happen.
And believe me, I know how painful that is. Now it's become enjoyable. Isn't it funny how finding out that you're wrong becomes one of the greatest joys of your life when it was just terrible?
When your pocket no longer depends on being hurt to say the right things, it is fun. It is so fun.
Yeah. Once your pockets are empty and there's nothing left to lose.
Which, by the way, family, that's a pretty much in your face. Send us some donations, will you?
Man, we're down to Janis Joplin doctrine now.
Golly.
Freedom's just another word for nothing left to lose.
Oh. You know, the guy who...
And that's where we are in the gospel revolution, folks. We have nothing left to lose.
We don't.
It's all gone.
We don't. The guy who wrote that song, not many people know, it was a Rhodes Scholar and was a helo pilot for the Army Rangers. His name is Chris Christopherson. And he also wrote another song called The Freedom of Your Chains. And that, oh, my God, that is what I did for 5 decades of my life.
Wow.
Yep, because I was a good Christian. Well, as far as people knew I was.
Well, you know my definition of a good Christian, right?
And I was a great liar.
Yeah, weren't we all? Goodness, we would just become professionals at it.
Now, where did I take you away from here?
You didn't take me away from anything. We went into, you completed verse 9, and we stopped for a moment because how was Jesus made perfect? I mean, we had to identify as what he was not perfect at.
Do you want to go into the teleos actually means complete, or shall we leave that alone for now? Because your explanation is pretty damn good.
We can bring both. Of the man, I don't see why not. Okay.
And that word in the Greek, made perfect, is teleos. Teleos actually means complete. It means it needs no further service, no further work, no further attention, no further creation, no further manufacturing. It's complete. So now I used to, one pastor's wife said, "We love what you do, what you preach, Beres, but we never know what to expect from you." And she was spot on. One day I handed out green bananas, and I said, "Are these perfect?" And everyone said, "Yep." I said, "Are they complete?" And no one could say yes because they weren't ripe yet. So there is a difference between complete and perfect in one sense, but it doesn't really – does it really matter?
Does it matter?
Yeah. No, it doesn't.
Depends on whether you like green bananas or not.
Well, see, how can you be perfect without being complete?
Exactly.
I'll leave that to you to explain.
Gee, thanks. You know, what I am wondering right here, though, is John 19:30. I'm wanting to know, this came to mind, because I know the Greek word is similar here.
No, it's not. There's no word in Greek sounds anything like similar. What was the verse again?
In verse 30. John chapter 19, verse 30. This thing just skipped its mind here.
When then Jesus took the vinegar, he said, "It is accomplished." Is that the word? It is finished?
Yes.
Okay. And declining the head. I love the way the Greek reads. It has been, this word is quite a different word, tetelestai. And it means, in the English, it assumes, has to be translated because of the mood tense and everything. It has to be translated, it has been finished. So when he took the vinegar, Jesus said, "It has been finished." Now, there is no relationship between tetelestai and teleos. Although the roots, they have a common root.
Oh, okay. All right. Now, why does the James Strong say teleo?
Because James is a dick. Because James Strong's, what he does is he puts the root of the word always there. Yeah. He doesn't put the actual word from the Greek text.
Isn't that funny? All right, continue us on.
Okay, we're up to verse, I think, 10. Mm-hmm. Chapter 5 of Hebrews, verse 10. If we keep going at this rate, we will be finished by Christmas 2023. called of God, a high priest. Now, you notice earlier, I'm just going to give my commentary as we go through, because the moment Mike starts talking, I've got no chance of getting in a word sideways. But you notice earlier they were called of men. They were called from amongst men. But this priest, whoever he is, was called of God a high priest after the order of Melchizedek. Now,
so we're talking about Christ, right?
Talking about Christ, I believe. That is contextual. Of whom we have many...
This Melchizedek.
Of whom we have many things to say and hard to be uttered, seeing hard to lay out, forget uttered. It's of whom we have many things to say and are hard to be laid out, seeing you are dull of hearing. Now, who's he writing to? Who is dull of hearing? He's writing to Hebrews, who have come out of mainline Judaism and disregarded the seven original Jewish sects, you know, people like the Essenes and the Nazarenes and so forth, and they have come out into what was called the Way, meaning the people who met on Solomon's porch in the temple, they were still Jews, as is proven a quarter of a century later by James's leadership. And James was accepted by the major Jewish priests, but they were thinking of going back to Judaism. So who are dull of hearing? The people who are thinking of going back into the law.
Yes.
For when the time we ought to be teachers... And why are you dull of hearing? Because by the time you ought to be teachers, you have need that one teaches you again, which be the first principles of the oracles of God, and you have become such as have need of milk and not of strong meat. Now, the word for principles in the Greek is stokion.
Mm-hmm.
And we have dealt with this word before, but what was the stokion of the and the oracles, the logion, the utterances of God, these were in the scriptures, the principles and the oracles of God. We discovered that the stokion were the principles of the law, the overarching principles of the law, the oracles of God, the utterances. That's where God says things like, "I'll beat your child, and when he grows up, he'll turn out right," and other such stuff. He says, that is all what you're going back to and are become such as have need of milk. If you want to go back to the law, well, you've just qualified yourself as a milk eater and not a meat eater.
Mm-hmm. And you obviously have no understanding of the perfected priesthood of Christ. That's the reason they're going back.
Yeah, because you're unskilled in the word of righteousness, which is the next verse, I'm sorry. Unskilled in the word, in the logos of Dikasuni, but you're unskilled in the word of righteousness. Who is the logos of righteousness?
Mm-hmm. Christ himself. Now, and what did he, now look at this. Let's go back just a little bit.
To chapter 4?
In verse 8 here of 5, though he were a son, yet learned he obedience. And what did you say that word obedience means?
Diligent listening.
Diligent listening. And this this works for people who do diligent listening. And now he's saying that because of this lack of diligent listening, you still stand in need of the law. If you're not diligently listening, you're going to need the law.
Oh, that's good. Say that again.
Jesus came into this perfection by diligent listening. He learned diligent listening through suffering. Then he says that this makes sense, this salvation makes sense to diligent listeners. And now he says it's obvious you are not a diligent listener because you're back under the law again. and you have need to be taught again. And this time, please listen. That's what he's saying here. You know, you have become those that need to be taught again because you didn't listen diligently at what was taught.
You are babies.
The reason for going back to the law, we're gaining a real insight here. Why are people under the law? Because they do not diligently listen. That's why they are under the law.
Love it.
And then that creates, because you don't have diligent listening, it creates a need in you.
And the need is for?
The law.
And the law is?
The law is, in this context, milk and not strong meat. What is strong meat? Strong meat is understanding righteousness through the faith of Christ.
Oh, wow.
That's the strongest meat there is, folks. There is no stronger meat. The strong meat is the word of righteousness. And indeed, that righteousness that is obtained by Christ and by Christ alone, by his faith and his faith alone, by his obedience and his obedience alone.
And so it is that we must leave you, family and friends. If you would like to know anything about the Gospel Revolution, call our office on
832-318-9339.
And speak to us about how you want to participate, or go to www.gospelrevolution.com and hit any link you like. Just go for your life. Put your feet up on the table, enjoy yourselves, take a bun out of the oven, and go fill your boots. So now it's good night from myself, Don Bartlett, from the GR Studios right here in Gospel City. And
it is good night from Michael Williams right here in the Secret City. That's what we're known as, Oak Ridge, Tennessee, the Secret City, the city that did not exist on anyone's map for many years. We now exist. And we are here to bring to you these incredible secrets that have been revealed actually from the foundation of the world. And we want you to stay tuned here. This has been an exciting day for me, a revealing day, and for Don also, I'm sure. And we're going to enter into some probably what would be called a little bit more familiar territory. But we're going to enter into it with a fuller understanding of what the writer is speaking of. Why? Because we are diligently listening.
Well, we sure hope you enjoyed today's podcast. And remember, we'll be here to do the same thing all over again next week. Only,
mucho better.
So there.
Gospel Revolution.